Hello and welcome to the program. Today, it's one of our rarest, most elusive birds, currently teetering on the edge of extinction. But could the corncrake be about to make a comeback? Protecting nature and wildlife at the heart of our capital city. The grounds of Oris and Uteron come under an ecological spotlight. And it's the perfect time of year to make a date to witness one of nature's most spectacular sights, a starling murmuration.
Ooh, it's now 20 past four. We've been here for about 25 minutes or thereabouts, and that flock has really built up. In fact, some of the birds are dropping under the bridge now to roost for the night.
Yeah, I mean, it looks to me as if we've probably got a few thousand birds now, and I think it's just going to build and build. So now they're going into about, a big loose ball shape, and they're soaring over our heads. Yeah, and more birds are coming in, sometimes just individuals, little flocks of three and four attaching themselves onto this big moving swarm.
Oh, and what a wonderful afternoon we had in Belfast on the Albert Bridge recording that piece of audio. Just to let you know, we'll be playing it in about half an hour or thereabouts. You can hear it all and learn all about starling murmurations. But these starling murmurations can be found all over the country. So ask somebody in the bird fraternity if they know where there's one happening near you, because it is one of nature's most wonderful spectacles. You're looking at me there, Richard, with your own spectacles. What do you want to say to me? No, you're Aina. He's Richard. Aina Glenn and Richard Collins are here. What were you going
to
say?
It is the great spectacle. People go to the Serengeti area to see the wildebeest roaming the African plains, and it's a wonderful sight and all that. But back home, right in their own doorstep, they have an equally wonderful sight. A million starlings in the sky. It's a wonderful experience to be under them and be showered in their droppings.
But keep your eyes open when you're driving at around four in the afternoon, and you might see them. I mean, I was driving across the country the other day. There was nobody telling me there was a starling murmuration, and I could see great swathes of starlings all crossing the road and going off someplace, and I was going the other way, so I could only see the lads coming to the picnic, as it were. But they're not just in Belfast.
I went to Belfast, the reason is that you can go to the Albert Bridge and they roost under the bridge, so they're going to be in the same spot each time you go up.
Yeah, I saw them.
If you go somewhere else, so like Loch Ennell, for example, who went last year, for sure they were there, and they were there in gigantic numbers, but they were on the opposite side of the lock, so they didn't come over our heads at all, and that can happen to you as well. I went somewhere where I could actually get you lovely sounds and create a nice picture. Now, Aina and Richard, have a listen to this sound. It's a bird. It's the backing track, I suppose, of Verily's Summer. It was heard by our parents as they walked to country schools. It was common on our childhood holidays in rural parts, depending on your age, of course. Once plentiful in all 32 counties, the numbers fell to just 136 calling birds in 2011, a decrease of 85% since the 1970s. They are now found only on the western fringes and islands. During our live Dawn Chorus broadcast in May last year, Blonidney Coffey brought us the distinctive sounds of the corncrake while she was at Fota Wildlife Park in County Cork, where the park's director, Sean McKeown, introduced her to some corncrakes.
Do you hear that?
That's lovely.
Yeah. Just as Derek was saying, go to your labba, myself and Sean, we just stayed back for a few more minutes to find out, just hoping we'd hear the corncrake, and there you hear it. That's the corncrake in Fota Wildlife. And we are so excited because we really didn't want Tori to be the only one. Well, we wanted to be first, but there you go, we got there. So there you have it, the corncrake. Isn't it really good? It's a really good sound.
It's terrific, Blonnet. Can we just have a listen to it, please?
Of course.
So the evocative sounds of the corncrake from Fota Wildlife Park in County Cork, brought to us by Blonidney Coffey during our live broadcast of the Dawn Chorus last May. The corncrake visits our shores between April and September each year, and while currently at risk of extinction, a new project aims to reverse its decline. Ireland recently won €4.3 million from the EU to fund a five-year conservation project for this endangered species. Dr. Barry O'Donoghue is head of agri-ecology with the National Parks and Wildlife Service at the Department of Culture, Heritage and the Gaeltacht, and he joins us now from our Limerick studio. Hello, Barry. Thank you very much indeed for taking the time out to talk to us. This is great news for the corncrake.
Hi, Derek. Good to talk to you again.
You too.
Firstly, actually, Derek, I need to congratulate you on the television programme you had out there just before Christmas also, Back from the Brink.
Thank you very much indeed. Yeah, you worked hard on it.
Absolutely, yeah. And essentially, I suppose that's what we're dealing with here, is a species that is very much on the brink, as you outlined earlier on. And so the corncrake was once upon a time ubiquitous. It was right across the country of Ireland, and it has suffered large declines in population and in range. So this project, Corncrake Life Project, will go towards working with local landowners, local communities, to reverse that trend, to try to restore the population.
So it's actually a grant from the EU Life Funding. So is Ireland the only country getting this? Are we the country in the worst mess?
Yes, so we're lucky enough to get it. We put a lot of work into it ourselves in National Parks and Wildlife Service with our partners in the Department of Agriculture, GMIT, Údarás na Gaeltachta and Fóta Wildlife Park. Put an awful lot of work into putting together this application, and we were delighted when we received the good news. So this money will allow us to put money into local communities to work with the landowners, as I said, to restore the habitats and the correct environment that the corncrake needs to survive and to thrive. So, yeah, we're delighted to get it and looking forward to getting going with it soon enough. Yeah.
Barry, are you sure we know what's happened to the corncrake? It's a multifactorial thing. You have this bird flying all the way to Africa. It might be declining as a result of something happening in Africa. It might be the journey there and back to Sahel getting wider. It might be something to do with Ireland and the way farming is done. Do we know the patient has presented and you've carried out tests? Can you say with certainty what the diagnosis is?
Yes, absolutely, Richard. You're absolutely right there. There's multifaceted aspect to decline, like there is with much of our wildlife. It's not just one thing in particular. And in this case, we're dealing with a bird that, you know, it's amazing actually for the size of it. When you think about the corncrake actually being maybe about 150 grams, about the average mobile phone, that weight or the size of a missile thrush flying from Ireland, from maybe the northwest of Ireland all the way down to South and East Africa, it's an amazing trek, amazing feat of nature. And there are many threats along the way. There are even, in terms of its migration also, there are parts of maybe around the Mediterranean where these birds would be persecuted. And obviously also then issues on their wintering grounds. And it's amazing when you think these birds might be hanging around in Belmullet or up in Fonnet during the summertime, out around Whitehead cows or Shirley cows, and then during the wintertime they're down around under the legs of elephants. So there's a number of different things going on in the wintering grounds, as you say, but what we can do here, and we have a real onus and responsibility and an obligation in Ireland to protect these birds, and what we can do about it is on our own doorstep. And we know that there are issues, particularly the move from haymaking, which would have been traditionally done, you know, down through the decades, to silage making, the homogenisation of the agricultural landscape, increased fertiliser applications, earlier cutting of silage, receding of grasslands, etc., more efficient and bigger machinery, all of these things. And even actually also on the other side of the coin, we have land abandonment in certain places. And the corncrake, she's a little bit like Goldilocks. It doesn't like its porridge too hot or too cold. It needs a certain type of management.
It's just right.
Exactly, yeah. So we're hopefully going to restore some of that balance in the areas that we're going to be working in.
So if you think about it, I mean, the corncrake comes back to where it was born. Isn't that right? I mean, they're faithful to their nest sites. So the years that the Shannon overflowed and the Callows were flooded, there were no birds fledged from those nests, which meant really then there were no birds with that imprinted on them to come back. And they have a very short life for such a big bird. I mean, it's only 2 or 3 years, isn't that all that they live?
Both up to 4 or 5 years, but yeah, some of them 2 or 3 years, that'd be it.
So I mean, the ones in the Shannon aren't coming back there, not because the Shannon Callows aren't maybe suitable, but nobody remembers having been born there. So how can you overcome that? How can you get them to spread? Or is it only coming out from the areas where they are at the moment, spreading it out from Mayo, from Donegal, or can you establish a new bulkhead someplace?
Yes, that's it. Yeah, you touched on something really important there. So as well as the drop in population, there has been a major decline in range also, 92% decline in range since 1978. So, you know, when you're dealing with a population, effectively, if all your eggs are in one basket, if something happens in that area, you know, so we've lost them from the Shannon Callows. Last time we had a calling male there was 2014. If we lose them from Connacht, or if we lose them from Donegal, the chances are they're not going to repopulate there naturally. So we need to consolidate those populations and build from there. And if birds do turn up elsewhere, like last year there was a bird in Kerry, birds will turn up in Sligo, we need to look after those also.
Is the model correct, Barry? The corncrake arrives back in Ireland, and it arrives, say, to the Shannon Carrows, say, if it came from there originally a long time ago. And it seems to need, it seems to assess the place. You find this kind of thing. I used to go to Inishbofin every year, and the corncrakes would call, a few corncrakes would start calling earlier, and then they would stop. And they, in other words, they seem to think, well, they tried the place out, we'd call a few times, see if there are any females around or whatever, and then when they find there aren't, or they don't get a good enough response, they say, we've got to move on, we're going to go up to Donegal, things might be better there. So is it a question that birds are tied to where they were born, or that they come back to where they were born, and if it's not good enough they are prepared to go and search elsewhere, and there must be a kind of threshold number of females around before they're going to settle? Is that model, it's nonsense?
So the general knowledge is that the birds will return back to where they grew up, where they would have, it's thought that they fix on the stars, that's their map to guide them back to Ireland again. But yes, birds will move if they don't have a partner. So if a male will drop into an area and he's calling, he's looking for a mate, he's hoping to attract in a female with his beautiful song. So if that doesn't happen, then he might move on again and try his luck elsewhere, as you say. Towards that, actually, there's GMIT, who are partners with us on the project. They have a really novel, innovative and pioneering project that will be underway using passive acoustic monitoring. So they will be putting out listening devices, listening for the corncrakes. And I suppose, just like us talking here, if somebody was to create a sonogram of each of our different microphones or feature our voices, we will sound different. And each corncrake also, if you analyse their sonograms, they will sound different, and you're able to identify, you're able to actually uniquely identify the same individual. So we will then hopefully be able to tell Larry here, this corncrake, he was calling in Falmore at the tip of the Mullet Peninsula last week, but now he's moved up to Binghamstown and further up the Mullet Peninsula next week. So we'll be able to get a better handle on the exact population, and also we'll be able to tell different individuals apart. So I really look forward to that aspect.
So who's moving from one place to another? So you were saying about Goldilocks' porridge, and that it has to be just right. Now, anyone can understand, if you give the place a number one haircut, which is what Silas Macon is in the month of May, there's not much cover for the poor corncrake, so that's fair enough. But if you just don't do it, or you abandon it, and you've got rank fields with nettle, surely that's grand. Why has it to be just right? Can you kind of outline the ideal habitat?
So if you imagine if you're a small little corncrake and you're trying to, okay, you need cover, you need that tall vegetation when you arrive from Africa in late April, early May. But then if that cover is too rank, if it's too strong and it's all matted, you can't weave through it, you can't walk through it, you can't run through it. And also your chicks will find it very hard to manoeuvre through it as well. So if it becomes too strong, if it becomes too abandoned, too matted, then they can't operate too well within that either. So it's oftentimes, I suppose, we associate the decline with the intensification of agriculture, and that is true. That's the major decline in Ireland, at least. But also, abandonment is also a threat.
Yeah, because a field that hasn't been mowed ever, like for years and years. The grass, I mean, it's a tussocky plant, so that you end up with a big tussock and a big tussock. So if you walk through it, even if you're coming down from the mountains and you have the misfortune to go through a field like that, it's actually much worse than the mountain itself, because you're up and down and in and out. So it's actually quite... So totally abandoned is no good either. Yeah. So what do you actually need then? So not the silage, because that removes the cover too soon, and not the abandonment because it's too hard to walk in. So then what is the management structure that isn't happening as much as it used to then?
So in some of those areas, you might have an area that's just totally become overgrown. It's all briars and bushes. We might need to get in and talk to the landowner and see if they would be happy to work with us. To get some incentive to put that land back into action, that there is some harvest going on there again. But obviously the harvest needs to be at the right time of the year, not during the nesting season, but after the nesting season.
So how do the hay meadows work then? I mean, the farmers were doing that not to suit any corncrake. That was just the way they were doing it for though. So what were they actually doing? When were they mowing?
That's it. So it was late summer. It'd be late August. September would have been more before. I actually remember hay being done in my own home place, and that would be the time of the year. It was good and late.
As late as that.
That allowed the... Yeah, well, we were in Kerry also, so I suppose we were wet.
Yeah, we were wet allowed. We cut the hay in July, but we didn't have many corncrakes now that
Then that would... You see, the corncrake also is what we call double brooded, so it actually might rear two clutches. It might rear two broods in a year.
Yeah.
So maybe the peak season for the first clutch might be in June. They might start hatching, but then they'll go again and you have your second brood, and that second brood would be really at risk. And actually these days even the first brood is at risk, because I suppose when the corncrake arrives from Africa, it will see maybe silage fields, that the grass is that bit longer than the rest of the landscape, and they'll say, oh, that looks really nice, I'll drop into that. But, you know, in a few weeks' time then, or maybe in the month of May or June,
they don't realise it'll be harvested.
Yeah, exactly.
Barry, Anna and I went on a most memorable trip to the Brzeza marshes in the middle of Poland. Now, the interesting thing, among the many interesting things there, were the number of corncrakes. And we were with a man who had took out his comb or his mobile phone, I think it was, and played a very weak corncrake sound into the... And up comes the corncrake right beside us, this sort of thing. So they had a tremendous profusion of corncrakes, but that was not the only thing. They had a tremendous profusion of everything. They had warblers, they had golden orioles, they had everything and anything.
But in that area,
it seemed to me that what was benefiting the corncrake was benefiting everything. Now, is our focus in this project too narrow? The whole rural agricultural world is going down as far as conservation is concerned. We've lost the corn bunting. Other creatures are the yellowhammer, for instance, the grey partridge. There's a huge drop. The whole is right across the board, of which the corncrake is one. Now, the various candidates for that seem to be the lack of diversity in the plant life, in the agricultural scene, and the result that there's nothing for the babies to eat. Now, should we be focusing in a general way and spending 5 million on trying to recreate the kind of habitat they still have in Poland? What was there in the 1950s with the flowers and the weeds and everything in it? Would that be the solution? Should we try to get back to that halcyon day long ago when corncrakes and everything else thrived?
You're absolutely right, Richard. And we would like to see our project as multifaceted, that it's not, okay, so the corncrake is out there as the flagship or the iconic species, if you like to call it that. He's the poster boy. But by managing for corncrakes, we're also hoping to manage for a wider array of biodiversity. So we have already trialled some farm plans. One example might be a guy that a lot of people on Twitter might know, Fergal O'Quinnigan. He has a farm plan with the National Parks and Wildlife Service, and he's ostensibly managing for corncrake, but in doing so he has created beautiful species-rich meadows that are actually hosting great yellow bumblebee, twite, chough, you name it. So we would hope to get to that stage, and we would like to see our project as multifaceted, as I said, but also not just looking at the biodiversity, but also looking at the communities in these areas, looking at the people, the landowners, the farmers in these areas. This should hopefully be money going into their pockets to maintain their viability also, because we depend on them. And also, I suppose, the Gaeltacht, that'll be a large focus of our project, and obviously being part of the Department of Culture, Heritage Gaeltacht, that's a major remit of ours also. You know, maintaining the Irish language in these areas, drawing people into these areas to come and see and listen to the corncrake, bringing tourism into the areas, more viable local communities. So it is a project about the corncrake, but we would hope to hit a lot more than that.
Yeah, because, I mean, getting the farmers to do it, I mean, they're the people who own the land. I mean, the last one that we did in Ireland was the Natterjack toad, and there was money given to farmers down in your own neck of the woods in Kerry to scoop out extra ponds for them, because the Natterjack toad was doing very poorly. And the farmers did, and the toads came back. I mean, we were all talking on it about how this was going to happen, like we're talking now about the corncrake, but we didn't ever come back and say, well, it did actually work. It actually worked quite well. And the numbers of Natterjack toads increased considerably because that was taken on board. And the farmers were advised, they got some grants to do this, and they did it. So I assume in the same way with the corncrakes, then they will actually be given advice by the agricultural advisors, by yourselves, as to what actually they must do. And then if they do it, they will get a grant to do this. I presume the money doesn't depend on whether the corncrakes come or not.
Correct. Yeah. So the
advice, not a bonus for the corncrakes arriving.
What one of the aspects of it will be that the better the habitat produced, the greater the payment. So we will be looking at a results based aspect to it, and I think that's fair. And obviously, like you say, we need the landowners advised properly, and agricultural planners, agri-environmental planners will be very much part of this also, that they will be talking with the landowners. The local project team will be talking with the landowners. And in my experience, and I've been working in agri-ecology now for a while, there isn't a farmer out there that actually doesn't want to see nature on their farm. They are out there farming day in, day out. They see the nature that's on their farm, and they would like to help it if at all possible. So if there are proper incentives and if there is proper advice, very important that the advice is there, that the habitats and the species can thrive.
So is it only a designated area that this money is for? I mean, because sometimes, as you know, when the corncrakes are coming, they might hit land in Wexford or someplace and they'd be calling for a day or two and then they'd push on. I mean, could somebody in another part of Ireland say, well, listen, you know, could I not sort of smarten up my place and have it for the corncrakes too? Or is this just confined to the areas of the west and north that you have outlined in the beginning, the Gaeltacht areas?
The project will be concentrating on 8 areas, including 9 special protection areas or SPAs. But obviously, if a corncrake turns up somewhere else and if it begins to breed somewhere else, say down in Kerry or in Sligo, outside of the SPA areas, then we would have an obligation also to engage with the landowners there to maybe delay mowing or whatever. So it's not necessarily part of the LIFE project, but we would be able to step in and engage with the landowner under a scheme that has been running since 1993, actually, the Corncrake Grant Scheme, and that would pay landowners to delay the mowing.
So there is a bit of flexibility then, yeah.
Barry, a terrible thought occurs to me. As you describe it, 150-odd calling males, now that has been the situation for a decade, 2 decades or something like that. So the population declined and plateaued. Now a thought occurs to me, and that is the danger of what they call consanguinity, a lovely big word meaning inbreeding, more or less. Is the population too small to generate the diversity that it needs to survive? Or have we any handle on that? Are cornflakes so confined that they always come to
corn
the same place?
Cornflakes or corncrakes?
Did I say flakes? I never eat
is
the
it cornflakes?
I'm sorry, it's my age, you see. I'm worse than the corncrake. But anyway, is there a problem like this? Do we know? Can we collect DNA from corncrakes? The males can easily be caught, I know, but the females not so easily. Can we do anything with this? Is there a hope of Scottish corncrakes coming in, or corncrakes in the north of Europe coming in, some genes into the population?
The key thing really is, I suppose, to work with what we have and to produce the habitat, and hopefully the birds will come thereafter. I remember a time when in the Mullet Peninsula there wasn't all that many corncrakes actually, and the population has increased there through the types of schemes that we've had in the past. So I would be hopeful that the population can respond. In terms of DNA testing, it's not going to be one of the objectives of the project, but with our project partners in Fota Wildlife Park, there will be a facility if there happen to be any corncrakes captured. If there was a situation whereby corncrake had to be rescued or whatever, then they would be able to host them. And they have some corncrakes there already, actually. So maybe there is some scope for something there, but it's not one of the objectives of the project. The core objectives would be to work with local landowners and farmers and local communities to restore the habitats and to increase the population.
Will you tell me the answer to something that's been puzzling me for years? Why are they not on the Aran Islands anymore? They used to be there up to the 80s. There's no combine harvesters there. They're not making silage.
I know.
The land use is the same as it ever was. So, I mean, they used to come, they don't come anymore. Why not?
Absolutely. And I was out there last year, actually, at the end of the Aran LIFE project conference, and that's another LIFE project that our department would have been involved in. And I just, the thought really crossed my mind as well, why are corncrakes not here? Because it just seems ideal for them, because you have this situation whereby, a bit like the burn, there's winterage areas whereby the cattle don't graze these meadows or grasslands during the summertime. They're left alone. So you imagine that would be perfect for the corncrakes.
Yeah, they haven't changed.
And no great amount of predators and, you know, no big machinery, like you say. So, yeah, it's a real head scratcher, right? And was it the 1970s or something like that since they were there?
82, I think, was the last one. Because we used to go every amazing. Year, so we used to hear them
Don
every
Conroy
year.
Used to be involved in the summer school. Where was that? Do you remember?
That was on
Inishbofin.
That's right.
That was the one and only time I ever saw a corncrake in the flesh.
Bofin is a great place for Corncrake.
That's
and,
right.
You know,
and
a lot of tourists go there.
As well, yeah.
A lot of tourists go there to hear the Corncrake. So, you know, just bringing
money
into the area.
Yeah, Torrey Island is a great
Torrey
place
also,
as well. Yeah,
absolutely, yeah.
That's a good place. But they are an island, so you'll have to kidnap one and put it there. Because, so it would seem to indicate there's some truth to the fact that they're not coming. Because, I mean, you know, it wasn't that they were mowed to death or killed on the Aran Islands. So maybe they just didn't make it across the Sahel and the Sahara when they were coming back. Michael O'Mara did a great project on that way back in the 70s. And that was the first research on the corncrakes. And that was at the beginning of the decline. And he was pointing out at that stage, because he had done some work in Africa, that the actual climate change was causing desertification in Africa, that the nomadic tribes who used to move on with their cattle and graze and move on because of population increases and because of the dryness of the soil, they couldn't move on, so that they were in fact grazing and staying in their areas, causing then the soil to be impoverished and the Sahara to get wider. So the poor old corncrake, which is actually not like the swallows and those who feed up in the air on insects, they feed on the ground. So you take a big deep breath at the bottom of the Sahara, fly across and come down, phew, in Morocco, and there you are. But now you don't do it in the night. You come down and it's still arid. There's still no food. How do you revive yourself to keep going the next day? So that was even then. So, I mean, that could well have an implication on places like the Aran Islands. Not that we did anything to them there, but they didn't make it.
Yeah.
So it's all to play for. It'll be great news now to see how it works.
I hope it works, because since I got into this business of making nature programmes, almost three decades ago, they've been talking about the corncrake and the plight of the corncrake. Am I right? Am I wrong, Barry?
Yeah, absolutely. I remember as a young lad actually going to meetings about the corncrake as well. It was one of my first memories of conservation. Yeah, so it's been going on a long time. Thankfully, we have sustained, you know, we haven't lost the corncrake from Ireland. I think that's something to reflect on as well. Thank God we haven't, because it's been a soundtrack to our landscape and it's part of Ireland, it's part of our island as much as any of us, and we would hate to lose it for future generations. So thankfully there are still some, and we need to hold on to them and we need to build on that population.
And for the last 2 years it's been the soundtrack to the Dawn Chorus, as you heard at the beginning of this interview, because we've been hearing the corncrakes sing live at the very beginning of the programme, because they're singing right through the night and into the early hours of the morning, which has been fantastic for us.
If you could call it singing.
Well, whatever. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Vocalisations. But listen, talk to me about GMIT and drones and modern technology and following the corncrake.
So I suppose there's, you know, when you think about corncrake, maybe some people think it might be like, oh, going back to old ways or whatever. But, you know, there's a really pioneering novel elements to this project also, and I may have touched on it earlier on, the passive acoustic monitoring that's being done on GMIT, listening for the individual corncrakes and analysing their sonograms to tell each individual apart. But also there is going to be a trial. Now, whether it works or not remains to be seen, but if it works, it will be fantastic. We want to see if we can pick out or identify where exactly the corncrakes are nesting, because to date it's been very, very difficult, because the female doesn't make a whole lot of calls. She stays quiet. She wants to keep her chicks safer. She wants to keep her safe herself. It's the fellas that do all the shouting as usual. We want to be able to see if we can pick out, through thermal imaging, pick out the female sitting on a nest through the heat signals that she might be giving off, hopefully. And if you're out in the field with a thermal imaging camera, maybe you're holding it at 6 foot high or whatever height you might be, then you are not able to see through the grass. So to get up above the grass, we would need to use drones. So we will have thermal imaging cameras attached onto a drone and fly overhead and hopefully be able to pick it out. If we are able to pick out the nest, that would mean a lot, because then we can engage directly with that farmer and say, look, it's this field that needs to be delayed, rather than having to delay maybe 4 or 5 fields that we think that she might be in. So that would be really great if we were able to prove that we can pick out the corncrakes through thermal imaging.
Barry, a thought occurs to me there. If you can find the nest like that from the air, you could take away the early eggs and the bird will lay again and raise them, as they have done in Fota, under hens or something. And just when they are about to be released, take them back so that they see the stars for the first time in the place where their real mother was. You could, in fact, greatly increase the number of young produced here. Is that a viable idea, or is it nonsense?
It's not part of the project objectives, but it is a viable idea in that it has been trialled with other species, and it's called head starting. It's taking the eggs or taking the chicks from the most vulnerable time of their lives and giving them a head start in life. So it's something that is an acknowledged conservation method, but it's not something that is part of this project.
It would be frightening, I think, to go up and search for a corncrake and steal its eggs. It seems an awful thought. I mean, the locals would string you up for doing such a thing, apart from anything else. But if you could in advance locate the nest precisely, it would be, you could go in quite quickly and with minimal disturbance take an egg or two, leaving the rest. I mean, they lay huge clutches anyway. So you could, it's a viable proposition without causing too much distress to the birds, or is it?
Like I said, it has been trialled, it has been done elsewhere, and I suppose the first thing is to see if the thermal imaging works, and if
can
it does,
find,
that might open
nests,
up a new vista for all manner of...
Yeah, you could look for curlew nests with that too, presumably the curlews are not in great shape either.
Yeah,
no, but you don't want to get distracted, you want to focus on the corncrakes and solve this problem for once and for all, if that is at all possible. It would be great if it were, and I can tell you, I'll let you into a little secret, Barry, because I'm working on a proposal for a new television project following on from Back from the Brink. And we're going to be featuring the corncrake, so we're going to get in touch
wonderful.
With you hopefully very shortly. It's great news for you guys, and we wish you the very best of luck with this project.
Thank you very much. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Barry.
Good luck,
Thanks.
Barry.
Hi, good luck.
Hey,
bye.
Guys, just while I have you there
yes.
as well, I heard earlier on you were talking about Oris and Uachtaráin, and just a nice little segue, if you'd like to mention it at some stage, is that in Oris and Uachtaráin, that used to be Lord Lieutenant's Palace and the Lord and Lady that were there, and back in the day, maybe even up to 100 years ago, the constables of the RIC, you know, whether you might want to mention that or not.
Warning,
they would have actually, one of their jobs would have actually been to stop the corncrakes craking at night so that the Lord and Lady could get a night's sleep.
How did they do that? Bait them on the head?
I don't know, maybe flushing them out of the grass, I'm not sure.
But that was their job,
it's
anyway,
an interesting
to tell
little
them to shut up.
So
even the Phoenix Park then, 100 years ago, or before 1920, was full of corncrakes.
Corncrakes, yeah, that's right.
Although, mind you, when I went to UCD, me and Finn McCool, in the 1970s, there were corncrakes out in Belfry beside the water tower. Because we used to hear them going in and out, because we used to come on the 11 bus and walk in. We used to walk on those days. Imagine we had legs. And you went down by the water tower, which is where it was a kind of a pondy place. And the corncrakes were there in 1970s in Clonskin.
Wow.
So there you go. I begin to feel like Finn McCool now. Or
we'll stay listening and we'll hear the first of Terry's reports from Oris and Uachtaráin towards the end of the programme. Barry, thanks very much indeed.
Cheers, guys. Thank
Bye.
You. Take care.
Good luck, Terry. Bye-bye.